You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com. Listen to Creating Maya as we go deep inside the mind of Maya Axton as she transitions from male to female. Get it at wearelibertarians.com. Welcome to the Chris Spangles Show. It is a pleasure to be with you today. This is a podcast about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we today are talking to an alleged comedian. His name is Josh Arnold.
Yes, the perfect way to put that.
Yes, Josh is a good friend of the Bob and Tom Show, becoming a friend of mine. I'm very slow to warm up, Josh.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah.
It's a long haul, like 2 years we'll be good buddies.
Okay.
So long, but becoming a good, very nice guy. You are like one of, you are Dyer and yourself, easily the two nicest comedians that come in.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And I have yet to meet Dave, and I look forward to it. So maybe we'll have a nice off.
It's not that great.
Oh, okay. But it would at least be pleasant.
Yes.
What you're saying. Yeah.
Oh, the two of you would be a pleasant off. Who's the most pleasant?
So you really do take a while to warm up to somebody?
Yeah, generally.
Do you think it's because you've been hurt in the past, or are you?
I'm busy.
Oh, okay.
I'm a very busy man.
I see.
No, I've not been hurt. I'm very friendly. I get along with people really well. But,
right.
You know, it's like if you want me to come to your funeral, we're gonna have to be know each other for like 6 months.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we're not on funeral terms.
No, not at all. Yeah, I'd be real sad if you died. So we're there.
Yeah.
But I'm not making the trip to Grand Rapids, Iowa, or wherever you're from.
St. Louis, Missouri. But yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's close.
See, that's the kind of friends you don't know where I live.
Exactly.
So that,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's right. You wanted to have the blues, the St. Louis blues thing on your crotch.
I will eventually, yeah. Much to the chagrin of the team.
I'm a real fan. I've got your logo on my crotch. Oh, well. Could you be Heather Locklear's daughter, please?
Yes.
Wait, have you seen her?
No, but I imagine if she's anything like Mom.
Oh, my God.
In her heyday. And she's, probably, maybe even still now, I bet Heather still looks okay.
She looks like Heather Locklear with booty.
Oh, nice.
So, my jam.
What's her name?
I don't, something Sambora. But
sure. Okay, so yeah. I can just look up Heather Locklear's daughter. Or,
right.
Yeah.
She was frolicking on the beach and it was top news earlier this week.
Excellent.
For good reason.
Yeah.
So it's nice to see you're a warm-blooded male American.
Oh, yes.
Like a nice lady.
I do, and I tend to be an ass man, so that,
all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm also a breast man.
Me too.
I'm a vagina man as well.
I enjoy those.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. So Josh has been coming on the show pretty regularly here on the Bob and Tom Show, and it's been nice. He's a very nice comedian. The other nice comedian, Carlos Mencia.
Ah.
And Gabriel Iglesias.
Oh, good.
And Gaffigan. Gaffigan, of course, you know, it's the Catholic thing.
Okay, yeah.
They're not allowed to be mean or they have to tell somebody. It's the Catholic thing. So what I want to talk to, I've been wanting to do stand-up comedy for a very long time, like since a child.
Oh, okay.
Because when I was a kid, I started listening to the Bob and Tom Show. I almost said this show because we're in the studios, fortunately. If you told little 8-year-old me that I would one day be sitting in Chick McGee's seat doing a podcast in the Bob and Tom Studios, he would call you a liar.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that weird?
It's weird. If you told 18-year-old me, because I would listen when I was in high school and Colin and I would order the CDs and play them, but just wear them out.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, it's still quite surreal to be here.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing to get to work here, but I've loved comedy since I was a kid. I used to memorize stand-up albums. I wasn't a sports kid. I was a comedy kid,
mm-hmm.
Because of the Bob and Tom Show. And so I've always wanted to do comedy. I never really felt like I could. I've worked in politics for 10 years. I've done public speaking for 15 in various different ways. And it's that's not the part that scares me. It's anytime you start doing something new, something that especially I think is vulnerable like stand-up comedy, it's always like it's like jumping out of an airplane.
Yeah.
It's the jump. It's the step before that is the scariest part.
Yes.
It's never the falling out of the plane supposed to be fun or else nobody would do it.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of in a place where I want to try it. I want to do it. I just, like, I can talk, and I know I'm a funny person, and I know that I can be conversational. And in a radio setting, I know that that's I'm good with that muscle. I know that I'm good with the public speaking muscle. It's the writing of the comedy. It's the actual writing of the jokes that I am totally lost on and I don't understand at all. And that is the excuse that I have used to keep myself from getting up on stage and trying an open mic.
Gotcha.
So I want to talk a little bit about that, but let's start with your jump. Let's start with your history. Get the audience familiar with Lil Josh Arnold here.
Yeah, and Lil Josh Arnold he's the one who started the comedy. I was in
really?
Kindergarten when I did my first stand-up set.
Okay, so I was the class clown.
Okay, yeah.
Like, I had like zero friends all through middle school. Then in high school, going into high school, like I had no friends. I was like one of the least popular people in eighth grade. Then at some point, I made someone laugh with a joke that I heard on the Bob and Tom show in eighth grade, and I thought, oh, if I make people laugh, they'll like me.
Yeah.
And so freshman year, I bulked up. I did some homework over there. I memorized jokes, started telling jokes. There was the joke of the day. People, and by the end of high school, I wasn't popular, but I was well-liked and got along with everybody. It's always been there. So you were kind of the class clown, too.
Yeah, yeah, I would make people laugh. I wasn't a blatant thief like you were. I would try to do original material.
No,
but
I have no originality in my body.
I say that, but my first stand-up set was the majority of it were Rodney Dangerfield jokes. My dad had gone on a business trip and he brought me back this like Rodney Dangerfield joke book that was. It looked like it was meant for kids because it was clean.
Right.
All the jokes were clean, and there was like a picture book. With jokes, and man, I loved them. And so most of the jokes I told were those. But
sure.
But I did throw in a few originals as well. And yeah, did comedy all through grade school. My dad would help me. That's a great question. I should mention. At the school variety shows.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Talent shows. Yeah. You're getting up there. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
so,
pretty good.
And they were exactly what you would, you know, it was second grade, third grade, fourth grade humor about being in school.
Right.
So, yeah, it was, you know.
A couple of throwing a poop line every once in a while.
You know what? I was a lot more mature back then.
Oh, you were
yeah.
being clean then.
Yeah, now I've become, yeah, now it's the poop jokes.
You get around Tom and it's like, you know, chocolate starfish.
Yes. Yeah.
Tom's laugh to me sounds like a Caddyshack.
Oh, a Ted Knight.
Ted Knight.
Yeah. Oh, Danny. Oh, oh.
What are you doing on Saturday? How would you like to mow my lawn?
How about a Fresca? Yeah, he does have sort of a Judge Smales quality to him.
He really does, yes. Listen.
Maybe that's why we love him so much.
Right.
Because, and I, you know, I wonder real quick. I wonder if the audience knows how much we actually enjoy Tom.
Oh God, he's the most. And I talked with, I don't know if I've talked about it on a podcast anywhere, but Tom is one of the most delightful people.
Yeah,
super generous.
It's insane.
People don't understand comedy, and so to have, to make this work, there's got to be a foil. And Tom is the guy that everybody attacks. He's confident enough in that.
Yep.
And he is genuinely peculiar.
Yeah.
But in an avuncular way. You know,
right.
It's adorable.
It is. Yeah. And it's really. And I also, you know, he's told me he likes drama and tension in a comedic fashion.
Sure.
So, yeah, you know, there are times where the mics will be shut off, we'll be on a commercial break, and he'll go, you know, I was kidding, right? It's just good radio.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, of course, Tom.
You know, I don't think that you are an enormous sack of fat
right,
walking around unable to see your own penis,
yeah.
And neither will any woman ever.
Well, actually, Tom, you never said any of those things, so, but yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, yeah, it's... but yes.
You understand how comedy works, right? I've heard that a few times off the air. Mostly directed at me.
Yeah, so good. Yeah, and... So, yeah, it was, you know, through elementary school. And that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. Mm-hmm. And then in junior high and high school, my interest shifted a little bit more towards film. I wanted to write scripts and be a director and an actor. And so all throughout, you know, from kindergarten to senior year in high school, I was performing in plays and doing comedy at talent shows and everything. And then really focused on writing when I went to college.
Mm-hmm.
Scripts for television and film and plays. And I had a couple plays produced in St. Louis, and I really liked it. And then got back into performing when I graduated.
I'm in total Tom mode. I'm like, what was the name of the play? Third Man In.
That is tough.
Oh, you were writing. Must have been something of the homosexual variety.
Yeah. That's great, Tom.
We could do a whole podcast just me pretending to be Tom and you pretending to be you.
I started thinking of a bit idea for the show of the like sort of dueling Toms.
Oh,
where
God,
yeah, where like four of us are just doing it and he's surrounded by yeah, so
you're in college. When do you finally get up on like an official stage?
So after college, I started doing short form improv and then some long form improv. So I was getting paid for it at a club in St. Louis. So we were, I did that for a while, and then these guys came in and did an improv workshop, and they talked about how they just went to an open mic, stand up open mic, and they were like, every improviser should try stand up just once, just to see the differences between.
Sure.
And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. And then I did it again. I went, oh, yeah, this is what I wanted to do for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And now I remember why. And so I stopped doing improv. Not necessarily, you know, not out of like, well, stand up's so much better. It was
sure.
Actually, there were a couple things going on that I started doing stand up around the time I was stopping doing improv. So.
Right.
And I'll tell you, man, you talk about that jump. I don't know that I've ever been more nervous than the first time I did an open mic as an adult.
Why?
The vulnerability thing. Mm-hmm. I was going to be talking about things that I was already vulnerable about, my weight,
sure.
Dating.
Right.
And
so, like most open mics, well, you know, I'm overweight and I can't get chicks like that. There's at least four of those guys every open mic.
There are, yeah. And you do tend to oversell the pathetic aspect of it without meaning to. Because you,
right.
Obviously, comedy is such a bizarre thing. And I guarantee I'm not the first person to say this, but it takes a mix of self-consciousness and confidence that on paper doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It's like you feel badly about yourself a lot. How do you have the guts to go up on stage in front
right.
of people? It's really interesting.
Here is why I am a giant sack of crap. Let's all laugh at me.
Yeah.
I think it comes down to wanting to get that appreciation, to get that validation, to get attention.
Sure.
You know, I've been going to therapy over the last year, and I've read a book called Scary Close by Donald Miller. And Donald Miller is a well-known Christian writer, wrote a book called Blue Like Jazz. And the book was about his codependency and about his discovering that he wasn't a vulnerable person. He was actually a bag of crap. And, you know, but here he is known for writing these authentic books about his life and his struggles with faith and, you know, and but really, at the end of the day, it was his upbringing, it was the codependent stuff, it was the attention-seeking that all kind of drove him to this career that got him attention, and he acted out. It just was really interesting. It was really like seeing my life story in written form.
Wow.
You know, and I see so many of the people that come through here that applies to, you know. There are, Jason just walked in. Jason seems like a very emotionally healthy adult.
Yeah.
So, you know, so he doesn't have the desire that you know, maybe Jeff Fibbert has, who is an incredibly unhealthy and emotional baby, and who wants to be famous. I say that in jest. But you... Yeah, I think that's, to me, where it comes from. I know that's where it comes from for me. It is that desire to be liked. It is that desire to please. It is that desire to get attention, because I don't always feel great about myself. Over the last year, going through therapy, I have definitely worked on that. I now have, I wouldn't even contemplate getting up on stage and because I can handle failure now because I've done the work.
Yeah.
You know, and gone to therapy and done the work. But I think it is that weird mix of I don't want you to see me, everybody look at me.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy. But that, you know, that said, I'm not a huge prescriber of the comedy as therapy sort of philosophy that some comedians have.
I get that. Yeah.
You know, I had such a rough life, I have to come up here and talk about it in order to feel better. I'd be lying if I said I didn't use comedy, or I haven't used comedy as a defense mechanism.
Sure.
Or, you know, I don't address certain subjects like my weight to sort of beat others to the punch.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm in control of it,
absolutely.
Maybe other people won't point it out or something like that.
Right.
I do comedy to entertain other people. Like, that's my main goal.
And I don't think people want to go to a comedy club to hear about, you know, your grandfather touched you as a child. Oh, isn't this funny? Like,
right.
So I'm with you on that.
Yeah, yeah. Or even girls don't like me. It's like, well, right. Explore, you know, that's not very funny.
Right.
Because, hey, dude, you're in more control of this than you think.
Yes.
We want to listen to people who are struggling but trying at the same time.
Yeah.
Just like a good movie. You want, you know, a hero who struggles is the best hero. But that hero has to be actively trying to overcome.
Well, it's just like dating. Like, yeah, I may be 290 pounds, but I'm trying to lose weight, and I have lost weight. I'm down from 330, you know. And, like, in dating, women don't care if you're broke. They don't care if you're fat. They don't care if you're, you know, this or that, as long as you're working on it. You know, women, too. Like, guys, if, like, all right, well, as long as you're working on it, you recognize you have this problem and you're working on it. Yeah, I think that totally is part of the human experience, and that's what comedy is.
Yes.
It's translating the human experience into a funny way that we can kind of all deal with it.
Exactly. And ideally, when you're doing that, you're doing it in a way that somebody hasn't thought of before or heard before.
Right. It's all about novelty in the brain.
Sure, yeah. I mean, every joke's been made. Every topic's been covered. But sure. If you can put your own personal spin on it, that's the key.
And there is, you can sit down, you are a very good comedian, very good writer.
Oh, thank you.
A lifetime of experience. You will never be able to write a joke funnier than your mom. Your mom is the funniest joke ever.
It's efficient.
That's what she said, and your mom, if well executed, nobody can write anything better. it's over.
Yeah, so don't try to, don't go for your mom.
Right.
Go for, and here's the interesting thing about those jokes, though. They might, if anybody considers them, and maybe they are the funniest jokes,
mm-hmm.
I can definitely see why you're saying that.
Yeah.
But the problem there is anybody can tell it.
Sure.
That's this. So, you know, you would want to try to stay away from jokes that anybody can tell. But, yeah. Man, they're hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
A well-placed your mom is sublime. It's perfect.
So how do you get to, so let's kind of skip back. So you go up on stage, you deal with the nerves, you work it out. Talk about the development of getting from a your mom.
Yeah.
Or that's what she said. In those early open mic days to being a professional comedian who can write jokes that make you unique enough that people will pay you decent amount of money to go out and work their club every week.
Yeah, it's and I'm saying this as a mostly Midwestern feature act. So for listeners who may not be, I do 25 to 30 minutes before the headliner.
Sure.
I like that role a lot. I'm proud of where I'm at. And mm-hmm. I look forward to headlining at some point? Yes, but I don't have the act for that right now.
Sure.
I do headline off nights, you know, a Wednesday, a Sunday, or even some off weekends, like a Memorial Day weekend or a Halloween weekend.
Right.
And I do fine. I'm not very comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. Audiences seem to enjoy themselves, but I do look forward to the days where I can headline confidently and the audience enjoys themselves.
So what is the difference between featuring and headlining in terms of the confidence in the act? What are the differences between those two?
As a feature, I'm kind of supposed to just go up there and do my material. Now, I Over the years, I've learned to talk to the audience as opposed to at them.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important thing. But I don't want to engage the audience too much, you know, in terms of doing crowd work.
Sure.
I feel like that should be left to the headliner, because one of two things can happen. I can either step on the headliner's toes or get the audience in a mood that or a mindset of, hey, we can talk to the guy.
Yeah.
Or we can talk to the comedian. And so and then if the headliner goes up there and the audience is just yelling out or responding to rhetorical questions, it's like, what the hell? Well, the feature set me up for that.
Sure.
So, and that's not that's just not my role. But I brought that up for. Oh, okay. So
the
I guess
the
what I'm saying is I just want a full disclosure on where I'm at in my comedy career.
Yeah. So you start out as an opener.
Yeah. Actually, you start out as an open micer.
Right.
And so my first open mic set, I had jokes, not street jokes, but I saw this commercial, and isn't this weird that they said that? That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing too deep, nothing very personal.
Sure.
Just, you know, a tweet, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a couple jokes about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, I went, oh, man, the jokes that I do about myself aren't as efficient, they aren't as well written,
mm-hmm.
but they're hitting harder. They're getting bigger laughs, and it took me a while, but eventually, and it took advice from other comedians, but for me to go, oh wait, I should be focusing on the jokes about myself and not so much the jokes about the Popeye's chicken commercial I saw.
Sure.
Greg Warren, who's been a big mentor to me, has made me a better comedian. Has also made me want to quit 100 times.
Yeah, I saw Dan Cummins here a few months ago do a set at Morty's, and I just walked out and I said, I'm just giving up I'm never going to do an open mic because I will never be as good as Dan Cummins.
Oh, right, I get you, yeah.
Yeah.
Greg he has made me want to quit, not only because he's a great comedian, I'm like, oh, well, comedy's taken care of or whatever, that's fine.
Right.
He's also made me want to quit because he's a tough mentor. He's harsh.
Mm.
And he gives you lessons he gave me lessons that I wasn't ready to hear, meaning it just came across way more abrasive than he meant it because I hadn't learned and I hadn't had the experience to understand where he was coming from.
Sure.
So when he would say, oh, you should never be doing, in 6 months from now, you should never tell that joke again. I would be like, well, but it kills now, and it would sort of hurt my feelings. I wouldn't understand what he meant by that.
Yeah, creative people are sensitive people,
yeah.
Especially when you're putting out something vulnerable. I mean, to hear criticism, you have to do it in a very specific way
right.
to not hurt.
But he would have never given me any advice if he didn't think I was worth it.
Right.
Yeah. But, so when you're first starting to write, a recommendation would be write about, I mean, they say write what you know.
Mm-hmm.
I say write what you know about yourself.
Sure.
I mean, that's, you would already be ahead of the curve if you were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Because write what you know, there are, how many open micers have you seen that live in their parents' basement and smoke pot? So they write what they know. They go up and they tell some joke about a song lyric or a video game or a snack food, and you learn nothing about them.
Yeah, because it's not like it's sort of a joke. It's not relatable. You got to be relatable, but it's totally true.
Yeah, and sometimes it's like, oh yeah, I saw that commercial, and that is weird, but it's superficial. It's
sure.
It's that's not to say that great comedians can't do great bits about, you know, the a commercial or a product or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But usually those comedians are very sly and skilled. And they're really talking about themselves,
mm-hmm.
when they're talking about those things.
Sure.
When Patton Oswalt's talking about the KFC Famous Bowl, he is making fun of the product, but he's also talking about himself there.
Right.
Why am I compelled to eat this?
Yeah.
Why are we compelled to eat this? That kind of thing.
Even Carlin, who is so well known for picking apart the English language and idioms and, you know, it's why do I use these stupid phrases?
Yeah.
You know, why do we do that?
Why do we as a people?
Right.
Why have we settled on this?
Yeah.
We should be better than that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I would guess you're going to be doing 4 minutes, 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
somewhere in between there. And the weird thing about it is, and why it also makes it so scary, and why it was so scary as an adult, even though I had done it, you know, as a kid and young adult is you know you're going to fail publicly. In order to get better, you have to fail. True. And not only that, you have to fail in front of people. It's insane.
Yeah.
Like, if you're a woodworker, you can build chairs in your garage and screw them up all day long.
Right.
Nobody knows but you.
Yeah.
No, when you're crafting an act, you have to fail publicly, and it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So, but I imagine over time you sort of build an emotional tolerance to that. You build a.
You would think so.
Oh,
and,
oh, really?
And to some point you do. Mm-hmm. And here's how that happens. I think, at least for me, it's okay. You accept the fact that you're going to fail, and then you accept the fact that if you don't fail, you might be doing something wrong, meaning you're not taking risks,
right.
You're not trying enough new material, you're not talking about enough personal stuff. You have to fail in order, you know, if I don't bomb at an open mic at least for a minute out of four,
mm-hmm.
I'm doing something wrong. It means I'm just going up there and doing tried and true material that I know I can kill with.
Sure.
And I'm not working out. I'm not bettering myself. It's like going to the gym and, you know, lifting 50 pounds for a year when you could be, you know, benching 50 pounds, when you could be up to 125, you're just being lazy.
Right.
So, yeah, it's when I bomb now at an open mic with new material, it still stings, especially when I go, oh man, especially when I'm laughing, writing it down.
Right.
Like, oh man, this is funny. This is done. This is good.
No.
But
I am. I think I'm the funniest person I've ever met.
Yeah.
I listen to my podcast and I just laugh at me so hard. Like, I'm just so funny. Like, I have the best jokes. But like, I know that not everybody else feels that way.
Right. And it's really weird when you're so convinced and then you go up and not only does not everybody feel that way, nobody feels that way.
Even you're not laughing anymore.
It's like, holy cow. How was I so off here?
Right.
And so this is kind of where I was going with when I was talking about, you know, being a feature act and stuff. The advice I'm giving now, or the insight I'm giving now, is based on a guy who I've been doing it for 9 years, and I don't think I've really found my voice yet. I'm close.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't even know if I'm close, because I don't know when I'll find. But I know I'm closer than I was. I'm talking more about what I want to talk about on stage than I was, you know, 5 years ago or even 2 years ago or something like that. Finding your voice is, some guys have it right away. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there are open micers who go up the first time and they know what they want to. They know what kind of comedian they want to be. Then again, they tend to be emulating somebody. A lot of times that ends up being Hedberg.
Yeah, I've seen a couple Hedbergs locally.
Sure, yeah. But once they put their individual spin on it, they've got their voice like that. And
the defined voice,
the sort of. The main character of your act. So, also, you know, the tone, the subject matter, all of that combined creates a point of view.
So, to make it relatable to the audience, Tom Griswold is peculiar. He is a germaphobe. He is, you know, list off any one of the qualities that you might have about Tom. You know, Chick is lovable, you know, Tom makes fun of Chick for being, aggressively masturbating constantly in public places.
Yeah.
You know, like, those are kind of Tom is condescending, arrogant. Those are characteristics of Tom's quote-unquote voice, basically comedy devices that everybody else can play off of and he can play off of as well. Is that what voice means?
Not so much the devices themselves,
uh-huh.
But, yeah, the character.
Yep. Having an awareness of who you are and being comfortable to have that discussed. Would that be it?
Sure. And you okay. can, I mean, maybe you can put it this way. Larry the Cable Guy would never tell a Patton Oswalt joke and
right.
vice versa, because it doesn't fit
sure.
their point of view, their life experience.
And Dan Whitney doesn't seem that far off from Larry the Cable Guy.
I think he kind of is.
Really?
He's way, I mean, he's as charming a person as you'll meet, and a gentleman. And, you know, I don't see Larry as much of a gentleman.
But there's something playful about
there
Larry.
About
Larry that, like, you know, like Ron Sexton does Donnie Baker.
Yeah.
You know, and so there is Donnie Baker in Ron Sexton.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, but, you know, there is a Coach Ralph Fontaine in Ron.
Every one of Ron's characters, I'd say there's at least some, right. Yeah, all of that are, you know, even Kenny Tarmack.
Sure.
Who might be, well, I guess it's an argument on who might be the douchiest of Ron's characters. But that's why Ron is so good, because you can tell he loves at least one aspect of all of those people.
Sure.
And same with Larry. Dan loves Larry, even though because I've seen Dan. I saw Dan.
Dan Whitney is Larry the Cable Guy, by the way. It's just if you don't know who Dan Whitney is, that's actually Larry's real name.
Yes. So. And I saw him about a year ago, and we were talking, and he said, He was talking about a Larry joke, and he goes, "Oh, it's so stupid," but he was laughing. So while Larry, I don't think Larry is aware of how stupid a joke might be. Dan is.
Dan, right? Yeah, exactly.
That's part of the fun,
right? Exactly, and that happens around here all the time. It's like, oh, this is so stupid.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so I get the voice thing. You know, I see it. You know, in the people that I'm around, I see that they have that comedic voices that are amplified. I just don't know, as a person who wants to start doing stand up, where to start in channel. I mean, because if I do it, I know there's things I want to say, and sometimes my things are too political. But I also, I mean, do you go up and you talk about? Do you write about things that are that you're deeply passionate about, or things that are painful, or do you pick things that are just really off the wall, stupid? Like
all of it.
How do you kind of determine what you're going
to
do?
I tend to write about all of that, but I am trying to focus more on the stuff that I'm passionate about. And well, it's all sort of tied in together because the stuff you're passionate about tends to be the stuff that you're most, that can be most personal, personal, or at least the stuff you're passionate about is an extension of you.
Sure.
So that tells an audience about you personally. And then the silliness is sometimes just icing or, you know, the spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down, that
right.
kind of thing. So if politics... Do you already kind of know that you want to be a political comedian, or
not really? I mean, I've worked in politics forever. I know it, but I'm kind of at a place in life where that's why I started this podcast, is because I want to talk about other stuff.
Okay, so like, you don't want that to define your
yeah. Like I am interested in the human experience. I think politics betrays that in a lot of ways. I think it's not making fun of Donald Trump's hair or any of that superficial stuff. Like, to me, it is the, what I have lately been most passionate about is people deny, like, we don't see each other as humans anymore.
No.
We don't see each other. It's like this, the Orlando shooting went from, oh, there was a shooting, ban all the guns, ban all the Muslims, this is a gay hate crime, and not, wow, this guy was probably in a tremendous amount of pain because he was, you know, he wasn't being true to who he was. Now there's 50 people who have died, and there are thousands of people mourning the loss of those individuals immediately, and the country is mourning as well. Instead, what we got was, oh, those cartoon characters, those fake bodies, now let's run into our camps and start arguing about, you know, it was never about having a conversation about the humanity of anyone involved in the situation. We immediately went to our tribes. And like,
yeah.
And we're getting into this place in society that I just hate. And I think comedy, in a way, can heal that. You know, who's the Southern comedian that we had? Stuart Huff tells one of the greatest stories ever that I love. I mean, he's such a... Stuart Huff is a guy that I really like. Southern storyteller. I wish I could tell a story like him. And, you know, he talked about driving down the road and he saw an accident and all these people ran over to help him. And as he's walking back, he's like, you know, not one of the six of us thought, wonder if that guy's gay. I'm not going to help him. Oh, I bet he's a Republican. F that guy.
Yeah.
You know, there's that. Like, that's the kind of stuff that, like, I don't know. That's the stuff that I'm interested in as I've kind of gone through learning how to be a person these last 2 years since I got divorced. It just opened up. I mean, I was a very stoic, closed off. I lacked the ability to be vulnerable in any way, very defensive, very mean. And I've opened up every emotion that I have and ripped off those wounds. Mm-hmm. You know, if you listen to Off the Air in any regularity, Chick and I are very similar in terms of our emotional life. And I'm learning how to manage that and kind of. So I don't want to be a political comedian, but I do think social commentary would be a part of it.
Yeah,
absolutely. And politics is a part of that. And how can we make things better? And I also grew up on Monty Python. I studied at the feet of Monty Python. I have a very weird sense of humor, and I also have a very crude sense of humor. I'm very, you know, the naked monkey ladies looked at Grace the other day and said, "We didn't realize Spangle was so vile." Women who have spent 20 years looking at men's buttholes,
yeah, yeah,
thought I'm vile. So, like, you know, so I can be crass and maybe sometimes a little aggressive. So I know those things about myself, and it just comes down to putting them into things that are going to be funny, because I don't want to go up and talk about, you know, the pain of my divorce and the adversity that I went through and how great everything turned out. Because that's depressing, you know, but that was a major thing that happened in my life. And there's been a lot of, like, weird shit that's happened over the last 2 years and dating,
yeah,
and dating after the divorce and some of that stuff that you know, I find interesting. But again, it comes down to any kind of creative work. It's like, man, I don't want to talk about me. I don't want people to think that I'm conceited. I don't want to.
Well, you already are, because you want to do comedy.
Yeah.
I mean that, but the audience isn't going to think that.
Sure.
It's always been weird to me. It's like, how does an audience not at one point kind of look at a comedian and go, why are we listening to you? Like, because they're at like a table of friends.
Right.
There could be six people at one table and they're just listening to this stranger. And the answer is because that person is also talking about them.
Right.
And putting things in a way that they couldn't do it themselves.
Sure.
So that's, you know, that's the magic of it. That's the greatness of it.
I started a podcast 4 years ago and told everybody that I was an authority on political talk, and you're just going to have to get used to it. And people bought it.
Yes,
it's really weird. Like,
so have you ever, so let's take your divorce. Have you ever said something about your divorce that has made your friends laugh?
I mean, I don't want to put it on tape because it might be a,
you don't have to. You, yes or no,
like,
it's fine.
No. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's where you start.
Okay.
I that's where I would start.
Okay.
Oh man, they laughed at that line. That's probably a good jumping off point for me.
Right.
And be forgiving with yourself, because the more personal you get, the harder it's going to be to hone.
Yeah.
So be patient with yourself and forgiving. And
what does that mean?
If you do, you know, let's say the first open mic you go to, you tell a couple jokes about something personal and nobody laughs, you still got to tell it 10 more times.
Sure.
You don't know. It could have just been that audience. It mm-hmm. could have been, you might need to change a word or two. You might need to change the whole thing. You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So let yourself figure that out.
Gotcha.
Don't just give up on something because it didn't work once.
Yeah, and that's what I love about stand-up comedy, and I've always loved about it, is that it's observing the human experience and putting it into, I mean, comedians to me are modern-day philosophers.
Yeah.
You know, the good ones.
Sure,
you know?
Yep.
Like, you look at a Patton Oswalt, you look at a Louis C.K., and these guys who are incredibly insightful about our world, you look at a David Letterman and the writers that he has and all these people, they translate our world into funny philosophical breakdowns. I love that. I love that there are modern day storytellers.
Yeah. And even, you know, sillier comedians do the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hedberg had an absurdist way of pointing things out that were, you know, very real.
Sure.
Jeff Foxworthy has sort of a lighter, sillier way of pointing out real things.
Right.
So that's one of the great things about it. There's room for everybody. Because, you know, so, oh, I don't like that kind of comedy, or I don't like, he's just too silly, or that person thinks they're so smart.
Right.
Well, there's room enough for everyone.
That's and that's what one thing I love about Tom is that Tom's not a comedy snob, and I'm not either. Like, I think, I don't know about Seth Meyers, but who would be a liberal? Like Andy Kindler? I find Andy Kindler and Mark Maron just as funny as Larry the Cable Guy or Bill Engvall.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Different kind of comedies.
Well, because they know how to talk about things without alienating half of the audience. Mm-hmm. And that's another, I mean, that's a tough balance.
Right.
Because in order to get there, you have to alien, you know, the pendulum has to swing both ways before you find that central ground. So
how did you, I mean, so you've done it for 9 years. I mean, what was kind of the timelines of moving up? I mean, how long did you do open mics before you got to open, before you got to feature? I mean, how did you kind of progress in that?
And this will be different for everybody. Mm-hmm. But I was doing open mic for a year or two. In fact, in St. Louis at the time, there were 3 comedy clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And the A room, it took me longer to get on their open mic list than it did the other rooms.
Hmm.
So A room meaning, you know, sort of, for lack of a better term, being the best comedy mm-hmm. club in the area. So the other clubs were good, but the A room had consistently better acts and better attendance.
Sure.
So, yeah, it took I was easily doing it for a year before I really got on the A room's list consistently. And that actually took guys, other comedians going, hey, man, you should be putting this guy on. You should be putting, because I would sign up every week and just not get on.
So how often when you were doing open mics, how many nights a week did you go up?
At least 2.
Okay.
Yeah, at least 2. But usually more because there are plenty of bar shows around. And
right.
And when guys start who run bar shows, which are usually tend to be fellow open micers or comedians, they if they like you, they'll say, "Hey, come do my show." And
sure.
And so, yeah. And so once I started getting stage time at the A Club, I was already pretty. I had a good 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe about a year after that, I got my first hosting week because that 5 to 10 minutes. Started to do consistently well.
Sure.
And I think I was told that I was ahead of the curve a little bit in terms of time mm-hmm. there. And I was ahead of the curve in terms of going from 10 minutes to 25 to be able to feature.
What do you mean you're ahead of the curve?
It takes guys usually a little longer to get to there.
Okay, you were
have that amount of material.
You were just such an exceptional comedian that they couldn't help but put
no, I was there. I was a hard worker.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, because looking at the local open mic scene, there are people who work really hard at it. Like there's a guy, gosh, I really want to give him a plug, but I can't think. Jordan Matterlich.
Yeah.
Jordan is a guy that I saw a year and a half ago, and I just went, oof, you know, just doing hacky open mic stuff. And then I saw him 6 months later, and I was like, okay, he's getting better.
Yeah.
Saw him, you know, a month or two ago when I went, holy crap, he's good.
Yeah.
You know? Like
yeah.
And it's because Jordan goes up 2, 3, 4, 5 nights a week, mm-hmm. and just it's like anything else, I think. It's all about the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours of experience. You know, you get good at doing anything if you just put experience into it.
Experience and
you put time and
yeah,
effort.
Exactly. And he's probably watching good comedy.
Sure.
I would guarantee it.
Okay, go ahead.
Because we're writing, you know, there's sort of an old creative writing adage, reading is writing.
Right.
And watching comedy is writing comedy. You as a comic, you watch comedy, you go, oh, I see how they wrote, or I see that sort of turn of phrase, or I see how they constructed that, what I have constructed it differently, or how would I have done it differently, and that kind of. So you're always kind of writing as you're listening to comedy.
You don't worry about getting like Carlos Mencia, though, where you either it matriculates or not matriculates it goes in through osmosis and comes out.
Oh, it happens. Yeah, okay. It definitely happens. I was at this open mic. I'd probably been doing it for 3 years, and I wrote this new bit, and I was really excited about it, and I went up and did it, and it did well, and I was like, oh man, I'm on to something here. And then this guy came up to me and he goes, man, that new bit is great. And I was like, oh, thanks, man. He goes, yeah, it's really funny. But then he went over. This was an open micer who's gone now. I don't know, who knows where he.
Right.
But he went over to a buddy of mine and he goes, hey, that new bit Josh did is a Chappelle bit. And why he didn't tell that to me, I have no idea.
Right, yeah.
So then my buddy was nice enough to go, hey, man, apparently that's a Chappelle bit. And I went, are you kidding me? And actually, he said it was a Chris Rock bit. I went and did my research, and it ended up being a Chappelle bit that I had seen certainly like 3 years before.
Right.
It wasn't verbatim, but it was close enough to where I went, oh, I should never do that again.
Sure.
And so it definitely happens. You just got to kind of go, oh, not on purpose. It happened. And
right.
The key is to then, it's going to happen. What separates you is how you deal with it.
It's like the itchy asshole episode of Louis where he and Dane Cook are hashing it out over stealing bits, and Louis's just like, who doesn't have an itchy asshole every once in a while? It's the part of the human experience.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
You know, and so it's not like he's like, it's not like I intentionally watched your itchy asshole bit and thought that's the greatest thing ever. I need to steal it.
Right.
It happens. You
yeah.
Know?
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And so that's. But I still kind of, I'm like, man, why did that guy come up and compliment me knowing the whole time he thought I stole that bit? That's what pisses me.
Right.
Comedy should be honest on stage and off stage.
The open micers are the worst in terms of gossip circles. It's just like,
oh, it's unbelievable.
Oh, I dated a local comedian and it just was like the rumors were so out of like ridiculous.
Yeah. And the best is to separate yourself from all of it.
Yeah.
And because it is, it's like, why are you, if you put half of this energy and time into your act, you'd be doing what Jordan Matherly's doing, getting better.
Yeah. I mean, Jordan Matherly, Brent Terhune. You know, Terhune is a writer for the Bob and Tom Show, and the dude just sits and rips out great lines.
Yeah.
It's because Brent just writes, works, features, travels. I mean, he's committed to it, and he's getting better and better and better by the second.
Yeah, yeah. Any comedian that gives the time to it is getting better.
Right.
I have had a I'm in the middle of a slow patch, and it's because I haven't sat down and written in a while.
So how talk about what you do when you sit down and write.
Well, it's
because to me it's the I can sit down and write the premise and the setup. It's the punchline that's going to be the hard part.
The punchline should come. I don't know. Some guy you can write you can kind of write a joke to. I mean, many ways, but two ways are you start with a punchline and then you write backwards. Those probably aren't. I don't know. Arguably, the danger, the pitfalls there are your setup is going to be convoluted because you're just trying to get to that pre-made punchline.
sort of like the show in the morning. Never mind.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's the other way is to just keep writing until you stumble upon the punchline. Sometimes you don't know you have a punchline until you get it in front of the audience.
Sure.
And all of a sudden they're all laughing and you went, oh, all
right.
That's right. A lot of times you think you have a punchline and it's all it is a sentence that furthers your setup. So I do this. Everybody does. You get up and you hit what you think is the punchline. Everybody's just staring at you like, and you go, oh, that's just part of the setup. I thought that was a joke, but it's not.
So then what do you point? Do you secretly, do you mumble into the microphone? That was supposed to be a joke.
I tend to be, and some, you know, this has to be part of the self, or the defense mechanism aspect of why I do comedy, but I'll point it out and go, ah, well, all right, that was a half-baked premise. I'll keep working on that. That I point it out.
Right.
Because that gets laughs.
That always gets the laugh, yeah.
But it's kind of it's a cheap laugh.
Right.
But I don't then, the next week, go up there, not having written more on that joke, and say, oh, well, I should keep working on that, to get that cheap laugh.
So do you sit there, in an instance like that, do you sit there and just stare at what you've got written and think and think and think? Like, how do you, in terms of trying to work on that bit, what is it talking
I
to
have the, done that.
Is it talking to people about that particular thing that then you work it out? I mean, what? How do
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I tend to relax. I try to relax. The more you focus on it, at least the more I sit there and go, what's the joke here?
Sure.
the harder it is to find, whereas it's sort of like trying to remember the name of an actor.
Right.
As soon as you stop thinking about it, it comes into your head.
Well, that's but that's neuroscience. So in there's two modes of thinking. There is linear think. Excuse me. I had a little belch there.
Yeah, you sure did. Everything okay? Oh, well, no.
All right, I had to birth it. It's okay. So there's linear thinking and nonlinear thinking. So when you are linear thinking, you're thinking about tasks, and your mind is going, bup, 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 I got this to do, I got to do that, da, 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 da. You know, you're at work, you're linear thinking, and your brain is incapable of doing creative thinking in that mode. And so when you, so that's why you get so many ideas in the shower or when you're driving.
Yeah.
And on autopilot. It's because your brain is not engaged in linear thinking, and you've allowed white space in your life to then, and that's why Steve Jobs would go on so many walks. He would just go walk. He wouldn't take an iPod with him. He would just go walk and kind of just give himself some white space
mm-hmm.
to just not have a day planned, and then he could go and do creative thinking. And I am very bad about that and about taking time to just be and not be, all right, because there's always a million things to do. It's like, I got to do this on the website. I got to post this. I got to do that. You know, there's always something. I'm so busy distributing the creative work that I never get time to work on the creative work.
Yes.
Between work and hobby, between these podcasts and Bob and Tom. I'm, you know, so it's just like, I just don't have the bandwidth to get to that other thing, but I've got to make time to do it, to sit down and write in anything.
And to sit down, or to not sit down, but to be, like you were just saying.
Sure.
And, it you know, start small.
Yeah.
If you have to go to Walgreens to grab some toothpaste, take the long way. Walk through every aisle and then go get the toothpaste.
Yeah.
What does that add? Four minutes to your life?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you'll, you know, there is that white space that you were talking about.
But we were talking about agonizing and punishing.
Yeah, so I'll step away from it. I usually step away from it. Also, sometimes when I'm stuck, it's because there's something wrong with the idea itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of times if a flower doesn't grow, maybe you planted the seed wrong.
Right.
And so that's always something to consider, too, is like, this isn't honest or real. Something's off here, so maybe I should go ahead and move on to something else. My issue lately has been everything I tend to, you know, the good stuff that makes me laugh tends to be more appropriate for a chunk of dialogue or a scene in a movie. And I'm starting to think that's probably closer to what I should be doing than stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
I still, you know, really enjoy stand-up. I still want to keep doing it, but
what's the difference?
I don't think I'm as... I think if I could live two lives, one focusing on stand-up and the other focusing on like script writing, I would probably be a more successful script writer.
So the ideas that you sit and think up and write are just very long form as opposed to... And not necessarily punch.
They're also not necessarily jokes for... They're not me. So right. I think of a really funny joke, and I'm like, well, I can't get away with telling that, but this character sure could.
Sure.
And it's kind of like I've never really liked, maybe I'm afraid of something or uncomfortable with something, but I don't like talking about myself nearly as much as I like talking about people. And mm-hmm. I don't mean that in terms of, oh, my gosh, did you see what, you know, Chick and Jason were doing today? I mean fake people.
Sure.
Like, wouldn't it be weird if this person, like, if there was a person who did this and that? And
yeah.
That, for whatever reason, that fascinates me way more than anything in my own, about me.
Right.
So that's why I think I would be better at that, writing for characters than, but that said, and maybe this, I love being on the air and giving my points of view on news stories,
sure.
You know, just riffing with everybody. And I think it's because, I can just be myself and not have to worry about the, I don't know. I guess I'm too new to the radio thing to really know why, but I love it.
It because it's electric. I mean, broadcasting is a totally different skill. And that's like, I know broadcasting. I know this side. I know how to do this stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to do what you do. But like I've the reason I started the podcast and have done hundreds and hundreds of hours of podcasting is to get to a place where I can one day have my own thing or my own show and learn how to build an audience by being funny and creative.
Yeah.
And that's a different skill than like sitting down and writing a 5-minute set that you're just going to do over and over and over for the next 4 months. You know, to me, that's almost boring. You know, it's like, that's just agonizing over a 5-minute piece of material and polishing and honing it for months is so much less enjoyable than this, because this is just conversation between friends, you know, and there's an energy, there's an electricity.
Yeah.
When you get into, it's just like your best friends, you're hanging out, you know each other's intricacies, you start to trust each other a little bit more. You get in a room with people that you do a show with on a regular basis, you know, Tom can look at Chick and, you know, they'll know just by looking at each other which way to take it.
Yeah.
And how to push the button to get the right reaction out of the other, or to set somebody like you up who may be newer. You just do it, and so it does, in a way, it becomes controlled. It's like if you're going to shoot a movie and you're going to go do a mockumentary and you're going to go out and do man on the street interviews, well, you want to have the homeless person already set up.
Right.
You know, so there is always a lot of setup in broadcasting, but there's way less preparation, way less work. A lot of what you hear in the mornings, like on this Facebook Live stuff where we were hitting you guys in the balls, or we're doing the beer mile. We're not having extensive conversations and storyboarding that stuff out. It's just organic and fun.
Right.
And it's in the moment, and it's a bunch of creative, fun people, like, taking a risk.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't work, and then when it kills and Vibbert throws up all over the concrete,
yeah,
we're all just ecstatic, and it's such a victory, you know?
Yes.
And I think it's because it's a moment that can never be recreated.
Exactly.
That is interesting and fun.
Right.
Whereas you're working on material that you're trying to perfect it to
yes.
Chick and Tom can look at each other and kind of tweak each other and get a certain thing. You're trying to build a muscle to do that with an audience of strangers.
Yeah, I think I want to, you know, as we're talking about this, it sort of occurs to me. Radio may be the perfect blend of this sort of radio.
Sure, general talk, yeah.
Yeah, of improv and stand-up.
Yeah.
Because two things that I absolutely love.
Right.
So, because I can be off the cuff, but right before I'm off the cuff, I construct a joke.
Sure.
So it's like slight preparation, but ad-libbing at the same time. And like you just said, you don't... Too much preparation on a bit like Beer Mile or the... will kill the bit.
Absolutely.
It'll come off as false or overworked. Yeah. And
There's got to be an hour of Tom sitting in here in the morning putting together news stories, and the 2 or 3 hours, the writers, you know, getting those stories, putting jokes together around those stories, feeding those to Tom, Tom editing them, Tom thinking about them. Like, there's got to be those sorts of preparations for everyday show, but Tom doesn't necessarily know how Chick is going to redirect that conversation, or how you're going to react to it, or how, you know.
That's what was so amazing about Bob.
Right.
He's such an incredible listener.
Yes.
In every day. I mean, nobody listened like Bob, and so therefore his responses were real and funny and genuine. I mean, he's also just so sharp.
Ad-lib.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah, his ad-libs were great.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know if I would want, you know, Tom was like, yeah, I can send you some of the stories, you know, so that you have them when you first get here. And it's like, I don't know. I don't know if I would rather have them or not.
I think not, because I think
that's kind of where I lean towards.
There's a lot of times where we're behind the scenes. We're like, don't tell anybody. It'll be a surprise.
Yeah.
Because people think it's canned laughter. They look at it and they go, oh, well, the canned laughter that they just put on those tracks. Like, that's not canned laughter. Like,
no.
I've sat in the room, run the board, as new bits are appearing, and, like, the laughter is genuine.
Yeah.
Because they're hearing comedy that Dean has spent weeks or months prepping. You know, people have been writing and working on those bits for forever, But nobody else in the room has heard that.
Right, not the people in the room.
Right, and so they're laughing just like you're laughing because they're hearing it for the first time.
Or if, let's say they do a bit that, you know, Chick does have a role in.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chick has only just, he's just recorded his lines.
Exactly right.
He doesn't know how they're going to be used.
Yeah.
He doesn't, he doesn't know what else is going on.
Only Dean knows, and Dean is an amazing editor and just, you know, he farts comedy. He's so full of it.
He's he's so funny.
Yeah. It's insane. I mean, Ron, too, the Donnie Baker call this morning was just unreal. Like,
and what a risk he took.
Right.
It was a dark, I mean, he made
what did he say?
3-minute phone call, he tackled child, underage sex, and suicide.
Right.
Two of the hardest things to make funny, and he did both of them. Within 30 seconds of each other, and it just killed.
It destroyed.
That could have gone terribly.
There's nothing funny down there.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess it doesn't sound that hard. It's just sort of keep a notebook of the things that you think are funny.
Well, you were talking about, you live and always have something on hand. And with an iPhone or, you know, with any smartphone now, it's unacceptable not to take time to either just jot something in the notes or record yourself saying, you know, something.
Yeah,
it's and that's the thing, man. You know, talking about writing comedy, there are no right answers.
Sure.
But you can't just, you have to be on stage. You just have to do it. And you have to let yourself go up there, you know, not necessarily with a parachute strapped to your back, but you're just holding it in your hands.
What's the difference between killing and bombing?
Well, just in a, you know, very in its simplest forms, doing well and doing badly. So
sure, but like I'm talking about the internal feelings that you have when you kill versus when you bomb. First, define bomb. How do you know that you just bombed?
When you're not getting laughs, but you're also not connecting.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of times as a comedian, you're on stage not getting laughs. It doesn't mean they're not connected to you.
Sure.
Some of my favorite moments in stand-up are when I have a longer setup or I start, you know, sort of riffing, I start ad-libbing about a topic, and they are completely attentive and just sort of hanging on every word.
Right.
They're not. It's not very funny at that moment, but they're with you.
Right.
So when you're bombing, it's like, oh, there is just a complete disconnect between me and these people.
So connection meaning you can just tell they're not listening to you. They're on their phones or
they're listening. They're not getting or feeling anything you're saying.
Gotcha.
And then certain things change. One person in the audience will start to resent you. One person in the audience will start to cringe because they feel so badly for you. Some people will just stop listening because you're not interesting.
Right.
And so then there's just this mix of discomfort.
I'm a go to the bathroom guy when I'm not connecting with an open mic.
Yeah. See, and a lot you'll oftentimes hear guys go, "Oh, comedians love it when other comedians bomb." What? Who? What are you talking about? Now, I'd be lying if I said, if I watch a really good friend of mine go up and take risks and bomb. Actually, you know what? No, when they're taking risks and bombing, I'm like, hey, good for you, man. Like, sure. I still feel fine. When a good friend goes up and does tried and true material that works 99% of the time and they bomb, it does make me laugh because because it's just further. It's like, you know what? Sometimes there's just no rhyme or reason to this at all.
Sure.
He's doing everything right. The audience wants nothing to do with it.
Right.
We've all been. It's kind of like watching somebody slip on ice. One of the reasons it's so funny is because you yourself have slipped on ice.
Right.
You know the feeling. So it's more of a sympathetic laugh than it is a, you know, Schadenfreude type laugh.
Sure.
So the main, I mean, you get off stage after bombing and it's like, wow, I did everything. I'm trying to think. I tend to blame myself. So because I see people, better comedians, and I'm like, oh, they would have been able to spin out of that.
Sure.
So But it's just like, how did I miss? How did I strike out so badly here?
I talked to a couple people, and they're like, every month or two, I just think about quitting comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Is that a common thing?
I think so. I mean, you do. Yeah. Yeah. You think about quitting.
You're just like, I don't need this aggravation.
Right.
I don't need this. I blah, blah, blah. Is it that sort of thing?
Yeah. It's kind of like, why am I doing this to myself? and it's a very, financially insecure profession.
Sure.
It's, it can get, you spend a lot of time alone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the kind of person that gets lonely very often at all,
mm-hmm.
but there is kind of a thing where it's like, man, I think back to days where I was like an usher at a movie theater working with 12 other people. And I was like, man, that was actually pretty cool.
With the ball busting and the fun.
Yeah. You go in and, you don't always have to. Yeah. I mean, and there's just, it's one of the more structureless jobs.
Yeah. And if you're not a structured person, a go-getter, I'm sure it's, you can.
Yeah. Yeah. You really have to create your own structure.
Right.
Or be completely comfortable with no structure, I guess.
All right, so final tips for a person that wants to. I don't think I have any desire to do it professionally, but I want to try it. And working here and I'm around it so much, I want to try it, and I'd like to do it on a regular basis. But I have no desires of traveling the country,
yeah,
featuring and doing all that stuff. Not at this point, but
sure.
Maybe I get up and I never bomb and I'm the greatest stand-up comedian of all time. It could happen.
It could happen. I don't think you want that to happen, though.
That's very true, because you want to fail a lot.
Because you'll get better.
Right.
You'll get stronger.
Yeah. Just like divorce. I'm a much better partner in a relationship because of my divorce.
Yes.
Yes.
You ideally.
No, but I can tell you for certain.
Okay, great. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you stay in contact with your ex?
I can't. No, not that one.
Okay.
Everybody else I'm friends with.
Every other ex relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
The ex-wife, it's her, not me.
Oh, okay, okay,
yeah,
I got you.
Yeah.
My advice, just some quick advice would be, you're never going to perfect your set on the page. You got to get up there.
Okay.
Don't wait until you have the perfect 4 minutes, because it will never get perfect without actually doing it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You need the audience's feedback. They're going to tell. Jerry Seinfeld put it best once when he said, "The audience tells you what's funny." Which seems weird, because it's like, well, I'm funnier than everybody in this room.
Sure.
And I actually had the guts to get up here and do it, and they have the nerve to tell me what's funny. No, they do.
Yeah, it's just like this. I mean, we are libertarians. We've done that podcast forever, and people, like, we did it for ourselves for so long, and then everybody just liked it.
Yeah.
And so now there is a little bit of like a hybrid thing where it's like, yeah, we're doing this for ourselves, but we also want to do it for you.
Yeah.
And everything that we do at Bob and Tom, it is literally all about the audience. What is funny? What is going to get people? What is good radio?
Yes.
And
thankfully, what's funny for the audience tends to be funny for the room.
Yes.
At least enjoyable for the room.
Sure.
Chick may not always love Tom's puns.
Sure.
But the fact that Chick expresses his dislike is fun for the room.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, I'm in the back laughing my ass off.
Oh, yeah, and so are people in their cars.
Sure.
Yeah, it's relationships that,
right,
that keep it going, which really relates to stand-up, too. I mean, it's jokes. Good jokes will get laughs. The relationships behind them will get bigger laughs.
Sure.
It's the truth behind them. But also, kind of think about things in this way. A great baseball player, a great hitter in baseball, what's average 350?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine? I bet if you'd sat down every baseball player and said, hey, for the rest of your life, you're gonna have a 350 average, they'd be like, great,
sure,
I'll take it. So kind of think about that in terms of comedy when you're writing, and mostly when you're writing, because
mm-hmm.
if you're batting 350 when you're on stage, that's not good enough.
350 out of
so if three jokes,
3 out of 10
hit a, yeah, yeah, right. You got to do better. But when you're writing, writing material, when you're coming up with new jokes, 3 out of 10, pretty good average.
Good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So just be patient and forgiving. That's the main thing. And really, and just remember, these people, audiences want you to be good. They're
sure.
rooting for you.
Yeah.
They are. It is not an us versus them. It can become that way, but every time it's become that way for me, I've never felt good. I've never been like, even if I've gotten huge laughs on letting them know that they suck,
Right.
Or, you know.
Well, it's all about likability, and you're a likable person. And I think the kind of person that sits there and goes, what's wrong? I mean, nothing is more of a turnoff than watching a comedian who is not doing well sit there and go, oh, I guess you people are just too stupid to get my joke.
Yeah, yeah. Or even the lighter, you know, sort of nicer way of like, oh, but, you know, it's like somebody tells a joke about babysitting, mm-hmm. and then they go, what, are you all babysitters here? No. They're not sensitive. They just didn't care for the joke. Yeah.
I guess you're not funny.
Yeah, or, oh, you'll get that one later. No, we got it.
Yeah. Nobody ever. I've been to hundreds of shows. I've never gotten one later.
Yeah. I guess I could kind of. I once was doing the show. This was recently. It was within 2 years. It was like 2 years ago. And I was bombing hard. And it was a small crowd, 20 people. And at one point, I just said, and it had been, this is by no means a humble brag, but it had been a while since I'd bombed this badly.
Sure.
And I said, I'm just curious. Do you think this is what happens every time I'm on stage? that I just do poorly everywhere
right.
I go? And this lady yelled out, yeah. And I genuinely wanted the answer then. Like, it was like, I wonder if they, you know, if you go to a Subway and they're making your sandwich and it's terrible, you open it up and it's falling. It's like, I guess that person's just bad at making sandwiches. No, they may have just messed yours up.
Right, they got dumped yesterday. They're just making a bad sandwich because they're thinking about the heartbreak.
Yeah, who knows?
Right. But 3 weeks ago, they were a sandwich artist, goddammit.
Exactly. But it was just really, and I don't know if she speaks for the majority of audiences. I don't know. But
right.
I just thought it was a really interesting. So I don't know why I was compelled to share that just now. I don't know what it is.
How do you deal with hecklers? Does it
I try
often?
To give them the benefit of the doubt now. I used to really battle them, and now I never felt, I would get off stage and I'd be like, oh, I don't feel good about that at all. Because now I try to, if somebody's just shouting out, you suck, I might go after them. But a lot of times I'll start with, you know, sometimes just saying something like, oh, haters gonna hate, gets a big laugh. It's like, oh, well, what are you gonna do? Especially if the rest of the audience seems to like you.
Bowers says that he just leans down and goes, do you think I want to be doing this badly?
Well, that's great. Yeah, if you're doing badly and you sort of admit, then yeah.
Right.
It's like, oh, I'm a person. I recognize them.
Are the hecklers mostly just drunk people?
Yeah, and a lot of times the heckling I tend to get is... you know, sometimes people jump on board the fat thing. Like, you know, I do about 5 minutes of being overweight, and then later somebody will yell, like, yeah, or even after a show, they'll be like, hey, fat ass, good.
Right, yeah,
and
yeah.
It's like, oh, they're just, they think that's they think that's okay.
Yeah. I see this all the time on the Bob and Tom stuff. It's like, people say, like, really mean, terrible things about Tom. And it can be very difficult for me to, like, look at that and not want to message that person and digitally beat the shit out of
him. Right, right.
Because I love and respect Tom Griswold.
Yeah.
And then I just have to kind of take a step back and go, okay, that is that way's person of trying to get in on the joke.
Yes.
And they're trying to, you know, make themselves laugh by playing to that character without realizing that, like, there are real people, like, watching that going, no, that's, Tom's not an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, so I get that. So
I try to now look at hecklers as more of a gift and less as a curse.
Right.
Unless they're just being completely unruly and mean. But, because a lot of times they are. They're just they like you.
Sure.
It's weird. A lot of hecklers like you. They just want to be a part of what you're doing.
Right, because they're attention-seeking, too.
Yeah,
they're mentally disturbed people.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So,
If you are at a show and you are not drunk and you are heckling a comedian and trying to insert yourself in the show, you're probably mentally ill, right? You're trying to make it.
That, or it's like, dude, you got to come on Tuesday night and just get up here. If you're this hungry for trying to make a room of people laugh,
right.
you got to come up and do this. You can't just sit in the dark and do it.
Yeah. I think that's what I would do. I'd just be like, why don't you come up here?
Everybody says that.
Sit on the stool.
Nobody ever takes, you know.
Yeah. Why don't you come on up here and tell us a joke? Bring your best one up here.
But there have been times where I've just gone, oh, man, you know, hey, I'm sorry you don't like me, but, you know, you got another act behind me and stuff like that. Sure. I'll just be completely matter. And then they don't know what to do with it.
Right.
It's kind of like when somebody cuts you off in traffic and you're so pissed, and then you look at them and they give you one of those sheepish waves, like, I know I fucked up. Like, you can't get mad at them. So, like, when I do that to a heckler, it's like, hey, man, you, I might not be your type, but, hey, you know, it's,
right.
I hope you're having, you know, hey, just grin and bear it for now. Like, it just shuts them down.
All right. Well, Josh Arnold, how can people get in touch with you, follow you, love you?
At that Josh Arnold on Twitter. Okay. That's
aggressively single. So if you would like to see his hairless fruit basket, you can hit him up on that Josh Arnold.
Well,
Twitter.
Chris, thanks so much for having me. And, man, I, you know, thanks very much for everything you do for the Bob and Tom Show.
Oh, well, thank you.
You just do terrific work.
Thank you.
And you're really savvy with all that, all the digital platforms. Digital platforms. Social media platforms.
This is on FaceTime Live. You have listen, you have no idea how happy I was yesterday when Chick goes, do you understand what you're doing to the poor boy? It's on Facebook Live. Try to promote the and it is. I just was in the room throwing my hands up in the air going, oh my God, I can't.
Yeah.
And, like, genuine exasperation going, I'm trying my best here. Just promote that it's on Facebook Live.
But you you work your ass off and it's much appreciated.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's very nice to hear. It's always good.
And hey, man, you know, let me know when you're gonna do open mic, and let me know how it goes and everything. And all
I will.
Stuff. We'll keep talking about that off the air, as it were.
That sounds good. And hopefully one day you'll get a podcast, and I'll help you put that on the internet.
That'd be great.
So, all right. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for joining us, Josh. And thank you for joining us here on the Chris Spangle Show. And thank you for subscribing. Please share this episode with your friends. This is a brand new show here on the We Are Libertarians Network, so we need you. If you enjoyed it, if you're getting things out of it, I've heard pretty good things about some of the episodes, and I appreciate that. Don't just tell me, tell your friends. Please share it. And if you're so moved, if you want to support the work of We Are Libertarians and the talk that we're now doing, please hit us up and support us on Patreon or through PayPal at WeAreLibertarians.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Hi, this is Chris Spangle. Can you hear how good I sound? I sound great. And you know why? It's because listeners like you go to WeAreLibertarians.com/wishlist, and you help us purchase new equipment. And then we take that equipment, and we hook it all up, and then we sound really good. And the only thing that can possibly go wrong is if I forget to hit record one more time. So, if you want us to help... If you want us to... Listen, getting new equipment isn't going to make everything better. There's still going to be problems with people like me and talking into the microphone. But you can make us sound really good as we're messing up by going to WeAreLibertarians.com/wishlist and purchasing an item today. It helps us grow, it helps us do more, and it helps us make sound better. Make sound better? That doesn't even mean anything. Well, I'm still not giving up, and I hope you aren't either. So please, WeAreLibertarians.com/wishlist. Thank you for listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Get our other shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.